It seems like when you get canceled by the loudest minority, they basically expel you and they say, you're out of our group. Now you go hang out with the B-cashers or the BSVers. You're a supporter of Craig Wright right now, even though I never acknowledged anything about him. And if anything, I donated money to Hadlonat and supported him. And I don't expect anything from him other than just being reasonable. It's fine to ask questions and it's fine to look for other stuff that's out there.
This podcast is sponsored by CoinATM Radar. When buying crypto with cash, an ATM is much more reliable and safer than meeting some random person in a random place. And unlike an exchange, which could freeze your account, you truly own all the crypto you buy. With CoinATM Radar, you could find crypto ATMs and other services where you can buy and sell cryptocurrencies for cash. On their website, you can search by coin, address, if the ATM supports selling as well as buying, and you can also search by geo area, country, state, city. You can also check and compare actual current fees at different ATMs. If you want to find out more, head over to coinatmradar.com, which is coinatmradar.com. Hey everyone, I have the fantastic pleasure of speaking with the one and only Vlad Kostya today. How's it going, man?
Hi, it's good to be on your show.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, and I, as usual, spend way too much time on Twitter, or X, as it's called these days, and I've kind of seen you in the background talking about things for a while, but I would just sort of assume that, you know, another person in the Bitcoin-only space, and just not a lot of crossover. And then, of course, I noticed when you interviewed Roger Ver about his new book, which, by the way, if anyone, oops, back over here. I do have it on the shelf now. I haven't read it yet. But that caused a lot of controversy in the, I would call it the maxi community, where people were getting very upset that you give this person a platform, but also very upset at some of the things you said about it, about you seem to be what I would consider to be a reasonable human being, but that apparently doesn't, some people don't always like that. So would you just like to quickly introduce yourself and what you do, and then just sort of go into this whole episode.
So I'm Vlad. I have been doing the Bitcoin Takeover podcast for 5 years now. It's a lot of fun because I get to talk with people who are much smarter than me, and I get to learn from them. And as I started learning, I understood the limitations of Bitcoin. I realized that Lightning cannot really scale, and not everyone can get on sidechains, and we need sidechains that actually allow you to own your own UTXO within a trust-minimized environment, not just a federation. So it's very easy to get disillusioned with what's going on and become nihilistic and say, oh, the plan is to capture this system and switch to paper Bitcoin, just trade ETFs or just digital numbers on your screen that are actually held by custodians. And it's also easy to be like this when you see that projects like Fidiments and whatever raise a lot of money to do their own thing. And when proposals to scale are controversial and people act like you're trying to destroy the system, even if it's within reasonable limits, or you just try to insert a couple of opcodes that allow programmers to build new stuff, and that is also perceived as an attack. I think I don't like the culture too much, because on one hand, I very much understand the whole idea of don't mess with the money, try to make it boring and predictable as it should be, but it's software. And that's the part where people lose the plot. They get so drowned in these narratives about what Bitcoin is and what it does, digital energy, and I don't know, the fix for every problem in the world, you know, as Jimmy Song, he's like, oh, Bitcoin fixes this. And then you forget what it fundamentally is and what it's supposed to do, because at one point you realize, what am I working for? You know, am I trying to make these very rich people richer because they're the biggest investors right now? Am I trying to please them, to impress them, to get them on my podcast? Or am I trying to look for something that's actually innovating and trying to bring the project back to its intended purpose. Because people are going to say, oh, you sound so much like a Bitcoin Cash guy. And while I disagree with scaling with big blocks as they do it, I do agree that Bitcoin needs a bigger block size. And there's an overlap of ideas. There's an intersection of this Venn diagram where I guess I find myself, where I agree with various ideas, but at the same time disagree with others. That makes me, I guess, cancelable by the ones who are the loudest and the least tolerant of them all. And I do remember the time when Bitcoiners were the smartest, most educated, and reasonable ones who liked to approach everything with an open mind and try to question narratives. Now, it seems like you have to stick to a narrative, and it's a cult where you get slain the moment when you step away from the crowd. And I have been meaning to interview Roger for maybe longer than a year. I bugged him with DMs on Twitter every few months saying, hey, Roger, do you want to do an interview? And I want to talk about this and this and this. And it just happened for him to come back around the time when he was going to release the book. I think I did one of the first interviews from his quote-unquote comeback tour. And a lot of people watched that and they felt betrayed. And they thought I gave him a very easy interview when they expected me to be some sort of court of law and put him on trial for everything that they perceived as being wrong. When in fact, he's been sued and he has ongoing lawsuits for various reasons. And it's not, you know, I don't have the entire information. Everything that I know is one-sided. I don't think I'm in the right position to conduct this type of interrogation, basically, and ask him, oh, what about this and this and this? I just acknowledged that he has a great contribution to the Bitcoin project. A lot of people got into this because of him, because he was giving away a lot of free Bitcoin in the early days. And he was also advocating for enabling payments with Bitcoin. And I think my agenda with his interview was just to tell him, you know, it's been 7 years since the block size wars. The environment has changed tremendously. I think there's going to be some sort of renaissance ideologically with people building cool stuff without permission, just like Jordanless and the Runes guys that are enabling use cases without requiring the rest of the network to agree. And Bitcoin Cash has failed in its mission. It's not Bitcoin. It is a big block version of Bitcoin, but they tried to co-opt the brand and say, this is the real Bitcoin. Obviously, they were not able to accomplish this. They did some useful experimentation with how large the blocks can be before you actually are no longer decentralized. I think BSV took it to the extreme, and BCH is going to try to have these, what do you call them, dynamic block sizes, where the market can decide to increase the block size by paying a larger fee, which I think is interesting, but not something I would gamble with Bitcoin. I think right now in Bitcoin, if we doubled the block size or tripled it, there wouldn't be a tremendous impact in terms of decentralization. But a lot of people around the world could get cheaper transactions, and that could benefit cheaper and faster because validations would come quicker. So
yeah, of course.
This is my point of view. I think layer twos are still the future, but you can't really onboard a lot of people on layer twos with the current limitations. And you have these two extremes, right? On one hand, if the block size is too large, you're going to centralize the system and you're only going to allow large players to run nodes. But if it's too small, you're going to end up having banks that enable the service that for which there is demand of low fees, maybe some confidentiality and scalability. So if you don't provide to these, there's going to be a free market that's going to provide, sometimes in the shape and form of altcoins that provide the same service at a cheaper rate, or with banks that are going to allow you to use the currency without any guarantee that it even exists and there are reserves. And we end up recreating the problem that we tried to fix.
Yeah, so just kind of continuing on that point before going back to the whole social discussion, which is also very fascinating. What do you think the ideal is as far as How many people? So first off, is Bitcoin L1 for everyone in any capacity? Not just saying you need to pay your coffee for it, but for people to be able to afford to use L1 to do anything. Is that the whole world, or is it just a subset of people?
I mean, if you keep it too cheap and you allow anyone for any reason to transact, it's not going to be decentralized anymore. So there needs to be some sort of reasonable threshold where you decide. I mean, of course, it's a decentralized project. It's the community that decides. Mm-hmm. It's the miners, it's the nodes, it's the ones who have economic activity on the chain. But maybe that $5 to $10 should be the point where we have a serious discussion, where we say this should not be the case because we're pricing out users who maybe want to onboard a second layer, or they want to offboard the second layer, because that's another aspect of it. On Lightning, you can't do cold storage.
Yeah.
You can do fast transactions at low fees. This is why it was designed. You have these payment channels, but you're supposed to exit at one point and settle the balance and keep everything on chain in cold storage. And also there's the issue of dust, where you have amounts which are no longer economical. You try to transact them and then you realize that they don't even cover the transaction fee. They're going to be stuck in the mempool and you're not going to get anything in the output. It's just the miner that collects the fee. So these are very serious discussions that need to be had. I'm not a big fan of the concept of digital gold. I think it was a useful narrative to explain to people who are not technical what this is, but I don't think it's the policy that we should follow. Because when guys like Michael Saylor say this is digital gold, what he means is that it should be regulated and treated as gold. And that means you're going to have large custodians and you're going to trade pieces of paper that guarantee, by virtue of some legal entity, that you're going to be able to redeem that amount. And I don't think that's the way forward, even though people are going to point out to that Halfini post where he mentioned Bitcoin banks and stuff. I don't think that's the vision. Satoshi put a peer-to-peer marketplace in version 0.1 of the code. It was unfinished. It was removed. It wasn't talked about again. But then again, what was the first use case for Bitcoin that made it get traction? It was Silk Road. It was a peer-to-peer marketplace, in fact.
That was the first killer one. Satoshi Dice as well, but that was, you know, fast, cheap, you know, gambling, I guess. But
oh, yeah, but we're not allowed to talk about that.
Well,
we're supposed to pretend it hasn't happened.
I am pre-canceled, so I can't be canceled for talking about these things. Yeah, so at this point, it seems like for my, like, I was there during the block size wars. I remember the whole thing. It seems like when we started to get like 50 cent to a dollar transactions, that was a red line for a lot of the big block camp. And at some point, of course, you had like high spikes to like $20 or more. And obviously that was a problem. But after the 2017 bubble, there's years of you could spend a few cents, but not just a few, but like 50 cents to $2 range for Bitcoin transactions. And that seemed to, for a lot of people, especially people who were using Lightning and other things, that seemed to be an acceptable situation. That then when Ordinals came in and they started going to $5, $10, $15, $20 and more transaction fees, then you had a lot of Bitcoiners start to complain about that. So do you think that, you know, maybe I'll pay, you know, a dollar or up to five for a transaction fee. If that's the experience for the Bitcoin layer one, do you think that's a sweet spot for you? Is that something where it's acceptable?
I think it's fine overall. There needs to be demand for block space. So the blocks need to be full because of this halving situation. Satoshi was very brutal in the way that he designed Bitcoin. He made it either succeed by virtue of a lot of transactions that make up for the decreasing subsidy, or else he bet that the price is always going to go up twice, 2x every 4 years. And I'm not sure if that's the case. It's a pretty dangerous bet. So we do have to collect fees, but the question is, if we're going to have a lot of fees coming from merge mined sidechains or something else, or we're going to have full blocks, and full blocks are going to be expensive. I think to some people, it's the safest bet. They say, yeah, we're just going to allow this small block size to get full. We don't care that people get priced out. If you don't like it, use Litecoin or whatever, or use Liquid. I tried to use Liquid yesterday. It wasn't a great experience. And it's unfortunate, you know, for this number one coin, this project.
Yes,
there's so much talent. There's so much potential in it. But at the same time, you realize that it's not fully, in terms of user experience, it's still rough around the edges.
Yeah, it's not something that necessarily everyone can easily use today. So as far as the L2 debate goes, it seems like, and which might be a big tragedy, the L2 has been completely made an equivalent of Lightning. If you're speaking about Lightning, you're speaking about L2. If you're speaking about L2, you're speaking about Lightning. And the entirety of the block size debate, from my memory, as far as a solution was, we'll just use a layer 2 like Lightning. Then there was the memes of 18 months. Oh, it'll be out in 18 months. And it was several years. And then it came out. And we finally hit a point where people are realizing Lightning can be useful for some things, but it doesn't seem to be the one scaling solution that everyone's going to use. So what's your opinion on Lightning and other L2s for Bitcoin? Are there any approaches that you think you would think were very promising? Like, for example, I've heard some people talk about rollups. I've heard some people talk about, drive chains and other merge mine side chains and things like that. What's your idea of what Bitcoin would look like in, like, say, 5 years once everything gets figured out in an optimal way?
I do like Lightning when it works, and I did spend more than a year trying to run a routing node from home, and I opened channels with people, and I was hoping to get some fees, because at the time, now people try to say, oh, it was never the narrative, it's just your misunderstanding of what it was. But at the time, people were writing articles and saying, here's how you can earn passive income with your Bitcoin. You open Lightning channels and you provide liquidity, and then you're going to collect transaction fees. Well, that never worked. I was collecting maybe 30 Satoshis a month, and I was paying much more than that just to open one channel or rebalance liquidity. And maybe it was because I had a Tor setup, which meant I was trying to not reveal where my node is located. And I used Tor to add obfuscation on top of the network connection. So maybe it was due to the latency and the transactions were not choosing my node for routing because it was slower. But it was disheartening to see this. And then we got to the point where basically, we started from this assumption that we're building Web3, and this is the real Web3 with our own nodes from home, and we're rebuilding that first vision of the internet by Tim Berners-Lee, you know, where everyone is their own server, and you run your own Bitcoin node with Lightning on top and some other services, and that's true sovereignty. But then you get narratives like, no, you shouldn't be doing this because it's not economical and you're slowing down the network. It should be more efficient. Let's use LSPs. What's an LSP? It's a Lightning service provider. What do? You open channels with that Lightning service provider. You do own your own liquidity, but you don't own the hardware. It's a compromise where you basically centralize the network for efficiency. But then you do centralize the network for efficiency and you still get failed transactions. And I think what killed it in the end and made a lot of people turn their backs on Lightning was when the ordinal inscription situation happened and Lightning failed to accomplish its mission because it was built for this environment, but it failed specifically because channels were getting closed down. And when a channel gets forced closed, I think the tools don't take into account, first of all, the ongoing fees. So they use the fee that was used to open the channel in the first place. So there were maybe thousands of transactions stuck in the mempool waiting for the channel to close. And it was just a horrible user experience that made it much worse. And now there are talks that we should get the soft fork to fix Lightning. We should do this, we should do that to save it, because there's so much capital and so much time that was invested in building wallets, education, stuff like that. And then you get guys like Fiat Jaff, who is the developer of Noster, and he says, burn it down, forget about it, just use drive chains. And it's surprising that a guy who spent so much time working with this and created the platform where people tip each other using Lightning is saying, no, don't do that. It's horrible. Just start anew with drive chains, because they inherit the same user experience of the base layer. At this point, everyone knows how to send an on-chain transaction with a mobile wallet or something. And of course, there are different trade-offs involved. But I do think that the point of Bitcoin is for everyone to be able to hold their own keys, even if they don't want and they want to go to custodians. They should be able, whenever they wake up and realize it's a bad idea, to withdraw and hold their own keys. Of course, it's not scalable in its current state. And for some people, it's convenient because they provide services that offer this convenience that they hold the keys for yourself. And that's a huge threat to Bitcoin's economic system, because at one point there's going to be another Mt. Gox event. We had FTX not too long ago, but people don't seem to be waking up. They're just fine with using and trusting some sort of custodian or bank or exchange, call it what you want. And I do see any solution that allows you to have your own, to hold your own keys. That's the whole point of this. That was the cypherpunk vision for internet money, to be able to be sovereign and self-custody. And if we don't get this on Bitcoin, we're gonna, basically, I believe that Bitcoin Cash and Litecoin and Dash and whatever, they are blackmail attacks on Bitcoin. They basically say, okay, we are technologically similar. We provide some of the same features that you do. If users are no longer satisfied with paying this, and also the Church of Maximalism, I'm going to call it this, needs to understand that the person in, let's say, Namibia or something in Africa doesn't give a shit about ideology. When they have to use something, they use the tool that's going to get the job done at the lowest cost. That's why Tether on Tron got so big. That's why Litecoin is so popular. That's why Bitcoin Cash is popular. They don't care. If they see that they have to pay, right now the fees are about $5. If they see that they have to pay $5 for a $10 transaction that they're receiving, that's a lot of money for them. And they're going to say, why don't I use this one, which charges 1 cent? Why do I care? I'm going to swap it instantly. I'm not getting exposed to the volatility. I don't want to hold this over the long term. I'm going to let the payments processor deal with this. So I think these altcoins are a blackmail attack on Bitcoin. And if Bitcoin doesn't scale properly to allow everyone to become sovereign and hold their own keys, it's fair game. And any of these has the right to exist and provide a service because the market demands it.
Yeah, so as far as the sort of blackmail attack on that, what do you think of the possibility that people, the whole idea of save in Bitcoin, spend in something else kind of thing, like let's just say a Litecoin, which is seems to be what the market is actually doing right now, where people might not want to hold Litecoin for long periods of time. They would much rather hold Bitcoin, but it's just not practical for payments. So it's they use, instead of L1 versus L2, they use expensive coin for saving and cheap coin for spending. So do you think that is a viable alternative? Do you think it's sustainable, or like over time, maybe they'll just only use one of the two and that won't work? What do you think of that approach?
I think it's viable until you get priced out of selling, because you're gonna save, right? But at one point you're gonna want to sell it. And if your UTXOs are not economical and they're smaller than the transaction fee that you're going to pay, that's going to be a very painful day in 10 days when you realize that you've lost your savings and it's just going to go to the miners. Of course, you can do something like with state chains where you swap ownership with someone else. And I think that's a pretty smart workaround for Dust. But I don't see it being implemented so widely. Maybe it's going to get more traction. As to altcoins that fulfill this payment function that Bitcoin is too costly to provide, I think it's much better than what Jimmy Song tells you when he says, just spend with your credit card. I've heard that so many times by Samson, by Jimmy Song, and all of these guys, like, just use Visa because you get points and it's actually more convenient. And then you ask yourself, why am I even here? What's the point of all this? If we're going to create more demand for fiat money and use credit card companies and claim that this is just a savings mechanism. I mean, I could have bought gold, I guess. Of course, it doesn't perform this well, but...
Yeah, of course.
Crazy.
No, with the drive chains idea, I had Paul on this show a few months ago, and it seems like the way it's explained, at least, it seems like the solution that could make everyone happy, that where you get the user experience you want, the features you want from other cryptocurrencies, but then you also get to keep using Bitcoin as a unit of account, and you get to keep having the small block vision of Bitcoin that, you know, now you don't have to worry about it getting too centralized or whatever because of too much on-chain capacity. It seems like the perfect solution, but at the same time, no one seems too excited about it. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. First off, what do you think of that? And then also, why do you think it is that way?
Well, I think there is this concept of rough consensus where maybe that the average person on Twitter runs a node and they're very vocal, but at the same time, it doesn't matter that much because it's the miners that have more power than they actually have. And if miners decide that they want to collect more fees, they're going to find a way to do it. And I think drive chains provide a solution for this demand for more fees to get collected. Also, ordinals do this. And I think ordinals for all of... I love them because they exposed people for who they truly are. Mm. And the same guys who are saying, oh, I'm pro-free markets and I'm this and that, are now tyrants trying to say this transaction is fine and this one is not fine.
Yeah.
And you can only be friends with me if you agree with me, once again. But also ordinals have compromised the debate about increasing the block size because now people can easily say, yeah, we get 5 megabytes or something plus SegWit. But what prevents these guys from putting more JPEGs? We're just going to make it cheaper for them to do this. And it's hard to refute, even though alongside these JPEGs, you can have a normal citizen who wants to have a financial transaction at a lower cost, and that's likely to happen. So I do like drive chains. I do like BIP300. I'm a bit confused about BIP301, but I think it's going to happen in the first phase because they did figure out that this can happen with these covenants. Hmm. So basically, if we get OpCTV or OpCat, which are the two most popular proposals for covenants, you can create trust minimized sidechains with BitVM. And I think that's going to be a first test by the free market to see if they create that, if it gets traction. Because drive chains, they get presented in these two extremes all the time. In one extreme, nobody cares. And they say, oh, we have liquid, we have rootstock. We see that there's not much activity happening there. So the market doesn't care because they want to gamble on Ethereum tokens or something. But the other extreme says, well, if these sidechains become too successful, they're going to take away Bitcoin supremacy and they're going to mess up the mining incentives.
Yeah.
And that's something that can happen. But at the same time, I believe in the situation in the middle where there is some demand, but not all the demand for this. And some people will want to use it, especially for the privacy features and for the ability to do smart contracts. And I do see it happening maybe in the next year because there's a lot of lobbying for OpCat coming from Blockstream, of all companies. There is Andrew Polstra. I had him on my show. He's very bullish on OpCat. He thinks you can build a lot of cool stuff with it. And there's also Robin Linus. I've also had him on my show, the guy who created BitVM. And he also wants UpCat because he believes it's mightier than UpCTV. And with these covenants, I mean, the average person is not going to benefit in any way directly from the covenants. It's sort of pointless. It's like a vaulting system where you put more transactions in. If you want, you can open a million Lightning channels in one transaction. Mm-hmm. But the closing of these channels is going to be a problem. So we're going to see how this gets mitigated, because obviously you do want to enjoy the benefits of this. But if you want to get out, the opt-out system is more complicated. I still don't understand it myself very well. There are smarter people to explain this. But I do believe that drive chains are due coming to Bitcoin within the next year. And it's going to be through these covenants. And we're going to see if there is any real demand for these, or we should just use altcoins.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of interesting. A lot of definitions start to sort of blur a little bit about what is a sidechain, what is an altcoin in some ways, because I remember, for example, Ethereum's wrapped Bitcoin, from my last recollection, had a significantly more volume, more TVL, right? More volume in there than the entirety of the Lightning Network. And Tron put out some post about they're focusing on a Bitcoin L2 roadmap where Tron will be the layer by which people use Bitcoin. They're going to practically be like that. And so I wonder how, if people will kind of treat these as altcoin Bitcoin vehicles, or if they'll treat them as using Bitcoin, but just a different way. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, I wouldn't call WBTC a layer two or a sidechain because it has a different trust setup, right? Mm-hmm. It's custodied by BitGo and issued as an Ethereum token on the Ethereum blockchain. And it's also available on lots of other Ethereum layer twos. But technically, even though it serves the function of scaling Bitcoin because it's backed by real BTC that's locked in contracts and custodied by a custodian, it's not that great. And I see a lot of these roll-ups projects that are coming to Bitcoin are actually aiming to take part of that market share, to eat part of that slice of WBTC and bring it to, I think that they still want to keep it on Ethereum, but they want to create a setup where they have bridges and there's less trust involved as opposed to using a custodian. I think that's still a step forward. I think it's still a good way, if you care about using these smart contracts and you want to get into DeFi, to use your Bitcoin. It's not something I would do myself because I don't understand it very well. And I don't advise you to do something that you don't understand entirely, because it's likely you're going to lose your money. But there's a market for this. And I can't be the guy to say, oh, you should not be doing this because, look, the dogma says this and this. And these are the only use cases for Bitcoin. And everything else is degeneracy. It's fine. But I wouldn't call it a layer two or a sidechain. It's just a scaling layer that's on another blockchain. It's like a synthetic version of Bitcoin that's issued on another network. And there are lots of chains that do something like WBTC. They tokenize Bitcoin, they lock it in contracts. It's fine if people want to use it, but you don't benefit from the same security and you should be wary of it.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess the same thing hits with the L2 stuff. Now, before we get into, you know, a few other things, on the social thing. So you mentioned like the Church of Maximalism and the whole, the way the Bitcoin maxi world has become a little, you know, culty, all this kind of stuff. And you mentioned also that Bitcoiners used to be the smartest people in the room. They used to be a lot more, you know, innovative and all this kind of thing. What happened, do you think, socially, since, let's just say the last 10 years, because Bitcoin's been around about 15 years, at least as a network. And I remember 2014, I was using Bitcoin all the time. I remember the community. I remember a lot of stuff. What happened since 2014 to 2024 that significantly shifted Bitcoin's community to be where a lot of it is this whole kind of maxi kind of mob that's going after you right now.
I think there was this disagreement during the block size wars where you had these two camps, one that wanted, I think everyone wanted to increase the block size. As a matter of fact, Bitcoin did do it with a soft fork. And they also made the extra 3 megabytes from SegWit blocks cheaper by 75%. And now some people were happy about it. How many years has it been? 7 years ago. Are saying, oh, it's terrible because it's being used by people who inscribe JPEGs. I mean, what did you expect, honestly? And you had the guys who wanted to increase the block size because that's the most conservative way to do it. It's the one that has been done by Satoshi in the past. It's the one that's been proven to work, but at the same time, it's also the more centralizing approach. It's not necessarily technically innovative in any way. And I do understand the small block narrative and the way in which it was conceived, because cryptography is only going to get better. And Bitcoin was built with early to mid 2000s technology. Satoshi basically pieced together something with stuff that already existed. And his innovation is the way that he put them together and he established some limits and parameters. And I do understand that there's going to be much better cryptography that's going to come in the following years. I do understand that zero knowledge proofs are going to make everything much smaller with a lot of data compression. I'm excited about that. Even Vitalik is excited about that and believes it's going to make the original vision for on-chain Ethereum scaling actually work. But he thinks it's going to happen in 10 years. And we all know what that means.
10 years is almost as long as 18 months.
At the same time, I do know that there's a free market for everything and it's useful to try stuff. And I think Bitcoiners used to be more open about trying stuff. If you look at Dogecoin to see what kind of people worked on it, you're going to see basically the entire class of Bitcoin Core developers making improvements to it in 2014, 2015 or something. They all were a lot more collaborative. And I think sometime in 2016, 2017, you had camps and they became more tribal and they tried to use... I don't think anyone was malevolent in any way. Everyone wanted what they thought was best for Bitcoin. Maybe it's better that there was a divorce. And I think at this point, the market has expressed its preference for a certain type of use case or which network they deem to be more valuable. I do believe that with the emergence of sidechains, we should consider ways to rebuild the bridges and get people back, even if it's hard to give up on the coin on which you bet your life savings or whatever. Just get together because the mission is pretty much the same. And where was I going with this?
About the community shifting to the way.
Yeah, I think Michael Saylor, when he entered in 2020, he was a very significant contributor to changing the culture. I mean, before that, you had guys like Tone Vase, like Jimmy Song, Saifedean. I think Saifedean also contributed a lot with his book. I don't think he expected it to be this popular. I think it's just the meme, the brand of a Bitcoin standard that propelled him to this level, because if you read the book, it's not that great, but people do like to use Zoom backgrounds with books. So they put a lot of books behind them and they pretend to have read them. Obviously, you were honest with this and said you haven't read it
yet. I have not yet read it. I probably will, but honestly, there's probably not a ton I will learn new because of how active I was during that time period and how much I know. But yes, I will read it.
But Michael Saylor was very effective at making this tribalist environment even worse. He came up with his memes about cyber hornets and digital energy, and there is no second best and stuff like this. He made everyone feel smart. He's using all of these metaphors and all of these examples and all of his tactics to sell more stock, to buy more Bitcoin, to appear that he's smart, knowledgeable, and capable of taking this project to the next level. And I think that DOGs are becoming complacent and tired of the whole situation. I don't see the same guys who are fighting for Bitcoin maybe 10 years ago being so active anymore. Maybe that they're so rich that they don't care about what's going to happen. But I do like the new generation of developers like Robin Linus, the guy from BitVM, and there are a few others who are academic cryptographers and guys who worked on Ethereum projects and then they discovered how they can build stuff on Bitcoin. I have a lot of respect for these guys because they looked outside of the bubble. They're not dogmatic, they're just engineers, you know? And they look for what's best and they do try to work around the limitations of both what Bitcoin can do and what Bitcoin consensus can achieve. I'm super proud of BitVM. Mm-hmm. I'm super proud of the idea of bringing rollups. I'm super proud of ordinal inscriptions for better and worse because they push the limits of what is possible and they do it in a way that doesn't ask for permission. I'm also bullish on BIP300 and drive chains, but this obviously needs the base layer to change. And the community and the culture needs to also change to adjust to allowing more experimentation. And it seems like the higher the price goes, the more of a pressure there is to ossify and say, okay, Bitcoin is complete right now. We're just going to leave it as it is. When in fact, it's not even fungible. We need some sort of real privacy for this. And it doesn't scale very well. And there's a lot of research right now in Zcash, which I think is interesting, with Halo 2. If you look into that, you're going to see that they were able to get these mixing pools where the average transaction is much smaller in size than a one input, two output SegWit transaction. And that's pretty impressive because the criticism of privacy has always been that it doesn't scale. It adds extra layers of obfuscation, makes the blocks more filled with large transactions. And also transactions are expensive. So I think Zcash is doing some very useful research in this regard. Mimblewimble has been a breakthrough, but it was not, I guess people gave up on it sometime in 2020, so 4 years ago, but it's on Litecoin and I think it does the job pretty well. And I'm excited about a lot of stuff happening around the space. It's just that I hope that people figure out how to bring it to Bitcoin because honestly, maximalism makes some sense when you look at it from the perspective of the most robust and decentralized network. You do want to build on this. You do understand that it has the most users and it has a lot of brand awareness and persistence. So there is virtue to this, but at the same time, being dogmatic and saying you should not look anywhere else or try something else, that's just stupid. I do see a future where everyone who's a conservative and thinks that everything that was not designed by Satoshi and was not made by Blockstream is a shitcoin and should not be used. These people are, I guess, dinosaurs. They're gonna get destroyed by any comet of innovation that's coming their way.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to see how this whole thing has unfolded over the years. Now, let me give a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a conspiracy theory type take or if it's just a maybe pessimist take or whatever, but I was at a conference and I heard from a lot of the Ethereum ecosystem. And it seems like the Ethereum ecosystem is going through its own like block size war right now, where over this last few years, Ethereum has obviously experienced congestion, but they've also experienced a lot of on-chain scaling things that were on the roadmap being removed from the roadmap, and the whole L2 boom and a whole lot of investors getting into L2s. And there's other, I guess, newer blockchains that are implementing a lot of these on-chain scaling things, like, for example, sharding, and they're doing it well, and they're doing it to where they can prove that it's doable without some significant trade-offs. And it seems like Ethereum is following its own version of Bitcoin's trajectory, where Bitcoin was one way And then eventually you started getting big companies and special interests involved that had, you get a lot of money that they say, we can't stop using Lightning because of all the money that's involved with it. And then you see development sort of ossify for the base layer to basically make this the second layer vision work out for a lot of these very well capitalized businesses. And do you think that this is something that's kind of destined to happen in crypto? And do you think it's, there's some kind of a corporate takeover, kind of not a natural, I guess, vulnerability in the way these decentralized networks are constructed, where a corporate takeover is kind of very appealing?
So if you're speaking about Ethereum, I think that the plan is still to make the base layer scale, and layer twos are just a phase in their development. It's just that there's a lot of demand for using the network right now. It doesn't scale, and they don't have the proper solution.
Yeah.
They do hope they're going to have Starks or whatever.
Some of the top Ethereum builders that I actually talked to over the weekend don't think that's the plan anymore. The plan is definitely not to scale the base layer. It is an L2 forward, like everyone should be using L2s at the end of the day kind of a thing, sort of like the Bitcoin one. And it is, if you feel surprised by that, a lot of Ethereum people were surprised by it too, because the change in plans for Bitcoin was very public. There was a big war over it. Everyone was talking about it. Whereas Ethereum, it kind of happened quietly, but there's starting to be disagreement. And so, sorry to cut you off on that. I just wanted to add that in there.
Oh, it's funny, but at the same time, it should not surprise us, because it proves which project is more decentralized and which one has more users who are vested technically into it. Whereas in the case of Ethereum, most of the users have no idea how it works. They just want to build stuff on top of it. And they don't care about some of these details. They don't care how. They just want to get it done. It's very culturally different. But it is very interesting when you think about it, that they made this decision behind closed doors, and then they announced everyone, hey, we're going to follow this scaling path. Mm-hmm. It is useful to have L2s. I think they're a more pragmatic way to scale, and they enable the free market to come up with solutions. So I think in a sense, even if it's transitory and it's going to lead to creating the kind of cryptography that enables the base layer to scale, allowing a free market for layer twos only generates, you know, you get big money coming in, they create these side chains or secondary layers, and they're going to discover something at one point, and they're going to contribute to the project at large, because of course they want easier onboarding on layer twos. So they're going to come up with efficiency improvements.
Yeah.
Well, I see the same situation on Bitcoin, but there was, I guess, we bet too much on one horse with Lightning, and we didn't care to look at other proposals. And then it all came crashing down when the fees were high, and we started wondering what else is out there. And then we had Arc that came along. We had these proposals for Chami and eCash mints, which I like philosophically because of privacy, but I dislike monetarily because you can't really audit the supply and you can get rugged. So it's custodial still. And we had, what else? We had a renaissance of proposals for sidechains. We have these rollups L2s that are coming, and they're not really complete in the sense that they do require some more stuff to be complete Bitcoin rollups. And I think there are a lot of types of rollups that are being defined. There's ZK rollup, Sovereign rollup, Optimistic rollup. I'm not sure entirely what's the difference between them, but I do know that philosophically I've learned about this from John Light. I think on Twitter, his name is Litecoin, LIGHTCOIN.
Yeah, I think I've seen him around.
And he does talk about the sovereign rollups, where basically you send a zero knowledge proof as an inscription and use that to prove something that's immutable. It's pretty cool. It's good as a concept. I just need to see more implementations. And most importantly, we get all of this cool tech, but we also need very good user experience. Mm-hmm. I'm still not sure how this is going to work, even though I like drive chains and I hope that they're going to get implemented. We're going to see a future where, for example, we have a zBTC, which is BTC on the Zcash sidechain. We have, what's the other one? The one that Satoshi created for assets.
I can't remember.
Namecoin, NameBTC, mm-hmm. which is going to be BTC from the Namecoin sidechain. We're going to have ETHBTC or whatever. And it's going to get interesting because there's going to be a market to trade these. Maybe that some of them are going to be more valuable than others. I'm not sure if there's going to be a one-to-one peg because on one hand, you have better security on the base layer, but on the other hand, you have better privacy on the Zcash layer. Mm-hmm. So maybe that there's going to be, of course, you can peg out and you get your Bitcoin back minus the transaction fee. But if you want to get out faster than the sidechain is going to shut down, you're going to have to swap and pay a premium. So maybe that there's going to be different prices for different types of Bitcoin. Not much different, maybe 1% different, but still it's going to be interesting. And how is this going to look from a user experience point of view?
Yeah.
It might be confusing.
Yeah, that's something, the user experience point of view is something that I think is very strangely, I guess, neglected in all of this. Because with like Lightning, there's a lot of different user experiences depending on, there's a lot of people saying it just doesn't work. And then some people say it always works for me. And a transaction will go through or it won't. And then you have a lot of sacrifices for a custodial way of doing things. And I still do not think that the adoption of Lightning as a methods for payment is in the top 10 of cryptocurrencies. So if you could send BTC on chain somewhere, that's probably the most commonly accepted form of crypto in the world right now. But Lightning is... I'm sure you could pay with Litecoin more places than you can pay with Lightning. I'm pretty confident in that, in fact. The drive chain thing sounds like a great idea. Also, Bitrefill is going to have, you know, their zBTC. They're going to have to enable the drive chain, and then you're going to have to do that through Coinbase, and then you're going to have to, every exchange, every payment provider is then going to have to make a technical change to implement each drive chain, or at least implement one drive chains as a whole. And that might be a little challenging, but if the user experience, if people trust it and the user experience is good enough, I think people will start to switch over to those things. If, you know, if it gets implemented, which I'm hopeful for, but I don't necessarily believe.
Fortunately, there is an alternative that's provided by the free market. Mm-hmm. Under the shape and form of altcoins. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they're much more volatile. And if you take into consideration the theory or the philosophical ideas of Adam Back, they're inflation. They're inflating the 21 million supply by providing extra features, and they're competing with Bitcoin in this regard. You can also see them as an attack on the fee market that is supposed to build on Bitcoin. But at the same time, what are you going to do about it? You can't push people to pay for something they don't want. They're going to look for a cheaper alternative that has different trade-offs.
Yeah. I guess the final big sort of point or question is about, you mentioned many times, it's just software. And that is, at the end of the day, what all cryptocurrencies are and what Bitcoin was. And just software that people run to do specific things. However, it's clearly a lot more than software to a lot of people. A lot of people ascribe a lot of values to it, and kind of obviously some people go really crazy with like the religious stuff, but a lot of people think it's this thing that's very valuable to have in the world. How do you see Bitcoin as being more than just software, compared to, again, the thousands of other cryptocurrencies, which are also just software? And sometimes when you put them side by side in terms of like technical capacity, it's not at all, it's much, much more competitive than when you put them next to market cap, for example. So what is Bitcoin that's not just software?
Well, it's a shared belief in a monetary system. It's a meme, it's a story, it's whatever you want to call it. But people put their faith into this project, and they projected a lot of energy and a lot of time into explaining what it is and how it can serve people who want to use it. And I do believe that the people who promoted Bitcoin in 2013, 2014, up to 2017 were very well-intentioned. And still, I do believe that Bitcoin should be used for commerce, should be used for any sort of markets, peer-to-peer markets, in-person markets, any sort of marketplaces. And it's the perfect instrument for taking the state out of the equation. You don't want to use government money, you're going to use Bitcoin. I think to some extent, some of the developers were cowardly. And I don't blame them, because you don't want to put your life at risk for some hobby that you have to code for something. And if the police comes to your door, most likely you're going to hand them your device and say, okay, just let me go. I don't want to go to prison for this. So they were cautious, and they did not want to add privacy or something else. They allowed more brave developers to build other networks that do have these features. But I think we're at a point right now where politicians and regulators are more accepting of what Bitcoin is. And even marginal improvements can make a whole lot of difference for people around the world. Even if it's a Mimblewimble extension block or some sort of Zcash sidechain or a big block sidechain that scales pretty well, it can make a lot of difference for a lot of people around the world who do want to not use government money and do want to have cheap transactions and faster settlements. That's just something that needs to happen. I do see other networks existing alongside Bitcoin for the simple reason that free markets always create demand for something that does not exist. And not everything is going to be part of experimentation with Bitcoin. I always see these altcoins as the experimentation layer. If it's not technological experimentation, it's social or economic experimentation. Most of them are scams. I agree with this. They end up losing 99% of their value, but they do teach everyone a lesson. Sometimes some people get rich off of them, but many times, in most cases, the users are going to lose, and they're going to converge towards the currency that is more stable. And the one that's been most stable over the last 15 years has been Bitcoin. Ethereum has been a second for a while, and I think it deserves some credit, even if I disagree with the way in which it was launched and the way in which it's being developed. It's more centralized, and it plays this political game where they claim to be decentralized. They virtue signal a lot. They have a marketing department. They have money to buy articles and stuff like this. They have a CEO, quote unquote, who's the spokesperson of the project. And I do think that they do deserve some credit for doing some research, because for all of the scams that happened on it, there was also some academic research that was funded. And we have a larger conversation about technology like zero knowledge proofs, about doing computation with, right now we have on Bitcoin, BitVM, which is entirely inspired by the EVM on Ethereum. Even if that one doesn't scale and people complain about it, better designs were made as a response to it. So the fact that something exists and is provided by the free market is only going to provide more innovation and more efficient ways to do it. And I also believe that Bitcoin Cash, and if some Bitcoiner listens to this, they're going to cancel me, but I'm fine with it at this point. They activated some other opcodes. They experimented with the difficulty adjustment because they're a minority fork, so they don't have the entire, or at least a chunk of the hash rate, so they do have to survive under this environment. And they did come up with some creative tricks to work around this situation and stay alive. So they do deserve some credit. And also the people who use Bitcoin Cash, Litecoin Dash, Monero, Zcash, they are remnants, you know, because they did not really have another all-time high. Mm. The price didn't really go up 2 or 3 times every bull market cycle. And the people who keep on using them and keep on improving on them, and they understand that there's something to them, I think are more, they have more conviction than the average Bitcoiner who just comes in for the good times. They enjoy their Lambo or Supra or whatever.
Super cycle.
Yeah. I came up with that one as a response to Dan Hill's super cycle. Mm-hmm. And all the Lambo culture. And I think it stuck in people's minds.
Yeah.
If Toyota sells more Supras because of me, I expect them to sponsor my podcast at least.
Yeah, they better. Yeah, well, that's a pretty fun overview. It's been an interesting chat. I think it's especially from the
perspective. Anyway, I just want to make a final mention. Mm-hmm. I'm still a Bitcoiner. I still enjoy calling myself a Bitcoin maximalist. And I still like talking about Bitcoin and looking at what's out there. The fact that the loudest minority does not like me hasn't changed anything. I still like what I'm doing. I still like being a contrarian. I still like asking questions. And I'm very happy with the position in which I find myself. It seems like when you get canceled by the loudest minority, they basically expel you and they say, you're out of our group. Now you go hang out with the Bcashers or the BSVers. You're a supporter of Craig Wright right now, even though I never acknowledged anything about him. And if anything, I donated money to HodlNot and supported him along the journey. And I don't expect anything from him other than just being reasonable. You know, I don't want him to thank me in any way other than just accepting the fact that it's fine to ask questions and it's fine to look for other stuff that's out there and figure out how you can improve this one project. I'm super happy with my position. I don't see myself becoming anything else. And I'm just going to continue my pursuit because it's what I do best. My sponsors were super chill about it. They said, okay, you caused some drama here. We're fine. We're not going to do anything radical. Even though there were a bunch of guys who tried to reach out to Wasabi Wallet and tell them, oh, how can you support this guy because he said this and he said that. And Wasabi know that they've been canceled also before. They've had their own situations and they know what it's like and they were accepting and supportive. And I thank them for this.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess maybe a last little thing that came to my mind is you mentioned about when you're expelled from the group, but that could be a good thing. And also that you want to call yourself a Bitcoin maximalist still. So you mentioned also that it's a loud minority that expelled you. So as far as the Bitcoin maximalists, the people who care about Bitcoin more than other things, how big of a loud minority do you think that was? And what do you think, do the rest of the Bitcoin space, are they still very, very reasonable and kind of on your side or at least tolerant to you? Or is it like half the space hates you, half the space likes you? What do you think it is? What's your gauge on the community now that you've been sort of a lightning rod for this?
It's interesting because there were no more than 100 people who unfollowed me. Mm-hmm. And there were like a handful of people who tried to attack me publicly. I think I can count them on the fingers from one hand. So there are these priests, high priests of maximalism, mm-hmm. who try to create these, how should I, like these feudal titles where mm-hmm. someone is accepted or is not accepted. And they try to tell others what they should be doing. They should trust this guy because he's a good actor. They should not trust this other guy because he thinks it's fine to interview Roger Ver on your show. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones that got triggered and they started tweeting. And maybe that there are like 500 of them that care. Only 100 of them unfollowed me. There's a bunch of them that still troll me in the comment section. And I'm amused whenever that happens. I mean, what I choose to do with my own life and with my own work affects them to such an extent that they take a chunk of their day every day just to troll me. I think that's flattering. It shows that they do care. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of guys who send me messages and said, hey man, I support you. I like what you're doing. I think you're right about this. Bitcoin needs to be a medium of exchange. We have lost the plot. This should not be happening to Bitcoin. But they're too afraid to express these opinions because they're going to lose some business partnerships. And I understand this. And the fact that this happens only restored the faith and rationality because I realized, okay, there are a lot of people who play along with this whole cult, but actually they think for themselves. So it restored my faith in the project altogether. But also, when I was in my darkest moment and I was feeling a bit depressed and I had no idea what to do, the guy who reached out to me and said, hey, calm down, it's going to get better, just ignore them. Mm-hmm. It was Charlie Lee, of all people, the creator of Litecoin. And I never met him in person. I never spent any time hanging out with him or... I don't know, I would hardly consider him a friend because we were never close. But he reached out to me and said this to me. And I realized, okay, this guy is trying to be friendly and is trying to help me. And the guys I thought were my friends are basically trying to make as much money from Twitter, from engagement, to slander me and say stuff like, oh, you got paid by Roger or whatever. Hmm. And it was a cold shower, I guess. I woke up and I realized, okay, I've been trying to please the wrong people. And it's not terrible to realize this. It's actually useful, but it hurts.
Yeah, it's more the being wrong part than the actual truth. So I guess the last little thing there, you said it, you know, shouldn't be trying to please those people. Who do you think you should be trying to please?
Myself and my own curiosity, honestly. I'll just pursue whatever I think is interesting. I'm going to choose my own guests. I'm going to see from all this plethora of stuff that's being built around Bitcoin, I'm going to find whatever I perceive as being interesting and follow my own interest. Because honestly, if you create content and you do it just for a group of people, you're going to be miserable about it. Mm-hmm. And you're going to feel like you want to explore more, you want to do more, you want to grow as a person, and you're going to be stuck with people who maybe are listening once a month, and they don't care about your own life and your own struggles. So if you don't do it for the sake of it and because you love it and because you find it interesting, I think you're doing it wrong. That's the whole point, to enjoy and to learn more for yourself. If you're not doing that, you're gonna end up quitting in a relatively short amount of time. So
yeah, well, it's a perfect place to wrap this whole thing up. Where can people find more about you and what you do and follow all your stuff?
I think the best place is the Bitcoin Takeover website, btctkvr.com. I bought that domain just because Bitcoin Takeover without a hyphen between the words, which I also own, but without the hyphen, that one is taken by someone and I expect them to make me an offer sometime. But I have all of my work indexed in there. I write articles, I do podcasts. I spend a lot of time writing about Bitcoin, and I do think a lot about how this can change our lives and how this can be much better than it already is. I engage with people and also have free open source magazines, which I published, and they're pretty nice with graphics and everything. You can download them for free. You can print them. You can give them to a friend. You can do whatever you want with them. You can sell them if you want. You don't owe me anything. It's just that I'm trying to share some resources and provide some knowledge, because when I first got on the internet in 2004, and that was 20 years ago, I was a video gamer and I was finding all of these guides on how to beat, for example, a boss in Legend of Zelda, how to finish this trial. this dungeon. And I always thought to myself that whenever I grow up, I want to be able to provide resources for people so that they don't have to struggle. So they find some answers to some questions that they have. And I guess this is my way of thinking the internet, whatever this means, with some resources that some people might find useful. And some guys found them so useful that they translated my work in German, French, and Spanish. So you can check them out in other languages too.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. Well, I'll definitely direct people to do that. Thanks very much for being on. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, have a good one, everyone.
Thanks for inviting me.